And today, the show is Worm's Eye View, news from the grassroots.
Right. And those of us who are here today are, well, my name is Maria, and I'm joined in the studio by Peter.
Hey.
How are you doing, Peter?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. We're also joined by Jessica. How are you doing?
Good, you?
Yeah, no, I'm great. I had a great weekend. I went camping in Golden Ears Park in the Fraser Valley. So that was really great. All right, first we're going to hear a song by MIA. It's a new song called Born Free. It was just released. And other than that, on our show, we have...
Yeah, so the first interview is going to be... an interview I did with someone from the Alliance for People's Health. His name is David Hendry, and it's in response to his organization's staged a picket in front of the Philippines consulate after 43 healthcare workers in the Philippines were arrested and detained. So they're healthcare workers here, picketing in support of health workers there.
Right. And in the second half of our show, we'll hear an interview with Erica Carmundel Fuchs of Justicia for Migrant Workers in BC. I spoke to Erica last week about her work with organizing migrant workers here in BC. It's a really interesting interview, and I was really happy I had an opportunity to speak with Erica. All right.
And if there's time at the end, we'll be listening to the poem What the People Want by Roger Farr, who is a Vancouver poet.
Right on. So we're going to get started with MIA.
Born free.
was MIA with the song Born Free. The following interview was recorded last week.
43 healthcare workers and Filipino civilians were arrested and detained by the Philippine government. Referred to as the Morong 43, all of them are still in jail. Last week, community organizations here in Vancouver staged a picket line outside of the local Philippine consulate. I am joined on the phone by David Hendry. He is an organizer with the Alliance for People's Health, and they are one of the organizations that were at last week's picket. Hello, David.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
Good, thank you.
So who are these people being detained?
Well, the Morong 43 were 43 health workers who were actually doing a... they were involved in a training for learning basically first aid skills is the course that they were learning, and it was within a rural setting. It's one of the number of educational events that takes place all over the Philippines, mostly done by the Council for Health and Development, which is a national organization. And the idea is basically to train local community health workers to do all kinds of different health skills, preventative as well as curative skills, so that they're able in their own way to take care of the health of their communities. And what happened was the Philippine Army came in and detained them and accused them of actually running a bomb-making workshop and being members of the New People's Army, which is an armed organization in the Philippines, and has been waging a civil war, basically, against the government of the Philippines for the last 40 years. So these healthcare workers who have been falsely accused of being members of the NPA and also of participating in bomb making workshops, and they've been detained since February 6th for basically just trying to learn health skills.
So to clarify, they were nurses or some kind of healthcare professionals?
There are a few trained nurses and doctors who were, I would say, leading the health training, but the majority of the people there were community members. So they were people in the local community who after they received the training, would kind of become like a health committee within that area.
Had their community health organization come under that kind of attack from the government before?
There's a long history of the civil organizations, the organizations that are kind of working for the poor and working for social change in the Philippines, as being linked to the armed movement. Yeah. And just as some context, there's definitely been those accusations, but there's also been basically a long history since 2001 with Gloria Macapagal Arroyo coming into power, of a long history of political killings. So there's been over 1,000 political killings since 2001, and in many ways linked to the Philippine Army. And so there's been kind of like an underground battle against the legal organization.
Has the government faced any degree of justice around this, or has it been mostly acting under impunity?
There has been no... there's been... As far as I know, there's been absolutely no convictions on any of those killings. And this is, as you can imagine, it's 1,000 people, but many of the people have been very, very targeted killings. So they're leaders of unions, journalists. In fact, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, there's been 3 journalists killed in the Philippines, teachers, peasant leaders. They're all people who, mostly people who have leadership qualities within their different organizations or communities.
What is the healthcare system like in the Philippines?
One of the statistics that we talk about in the Alliance of People's for People's Health is that, just to give an example, that the amount of money that goes towards the healthcare system, and I have a few stats in my mind. One of them is that the military takes up about, I believe it's about 6 times more than the healthcare budget in the Philippines, which is pretty unimaginable here in Canada. But also the money that goes towards debt repayment, so towards the IMF and World Bank debts that the Philippines has incurred, is actually 63 times the amount that the health the healthcare system gets. So it's badly underfunded. In the Philippines, most of the nurses and doctors that are trained are actually for export, and so there many nurses and doctors are trained, but there are no jobs. The jobs that are there are very low paid, and most out of extreme poverty have to go abroad and try to make money in other countries for their families. So when I was in the Philippines in 2008, as part of the Alliance for People's Health, we went into the rural areas and saw that you know, the people that we talked to had never seen a doctor before in their lives. There had never been a doctor in the community before. So really the healthcare system is for the rich and for the privileged middle class, I would say.
So your organization has done work in the Philippines. Do you have any connections with some of these healthcare workers who have come under attack?
Yes, actually, which is one of the reasons why we're so passionate about this, because when I was in the Philippines in 2008, and one of our other members who is a midwife, Martha Roberts, was actually there for 8 months, a number of the staff and the doctors and nurses that we were with on a daily basis and doing health education, a number of them have been detained. There's 3 in particular that I knew and that Martha knew. One of them is Dr. Mary Mia Clamore. There's a midwife that Martha has known since 2003, Teresa Kinawayan, and one of the staff at Council for Health and Development, whose name is Ray Macabenta. Ray was actually my driver when I arrived in the Philippines, and was kind of babysitter for Martha's children when she was in some areas of the Philippines. So, you know, we saw these people do amazing community health work, going into the middle of nowhere and doing educational events, administering care, delivering babies, doing really, really amazing work. And it was definitely very heartbreaking and just unbelievable that these people would be charged with building bombs and committing acts of violence. It's unbelievable.
And so that is how the government justifies it. Why do you think they were arrested and detained?
I think it is. It's an attack. It's despite them not having any evidence at all. You know, despite them having no warrants, they have been illegally arrested and illegally detained since February the 6th. Despite all of that, they've been attacked. They've been tortured. Their health has been deteriorating over the last 6 months. So it's an attack on an organization that is trying to see social change in the Philippines, and that is what the Philippine government and the wealthy elite in the Philippines don't want to see. So they resort to defamation and illegal detention and in the past and ongoing, they've engaged in killings and disappearances as well. So it's just another incident of attack on legal organizations, whether it be human rights organizations, health organizations, peasant organizations, organizations of the poor. They've been attacked in many different ways.
And so you were part of a picket in front of the Philippine consulate last week, and it took place on the inauguration day of the newly elected president, Aquino. Why was he a target?
Well, he does have the influence and the ability now to immediately release the illegally detained health workers. So he has that ability, and he also comes from historically he comes from a progressive background, and so there is cautious optimism anyway in the Philippines that he might be able to firstly that he would release the Morong 43, but also there's some hope that he might. He might chart a different path in the Philippines. He is the son of the past president, and also his father was actually detained during the Marcos regime in the 1970s and was assassinated by the regime. So he's seen as a, because of that history, he's seen as a more progressive person in the government, but it's definitely cautious, I would say. But we're hoping that with enough international pressure and enough pressure within the Philippines that the health workers will be released.
And was his platform any different from his predecessor in terms of this impunity or healthcare reform?
From the little that I know, I don't have a really good sense of Philippines politics right now, but from what I understand, one of his big platforms was ending corruption that was quite rampant during the last presidential the last presidential reign under Arroyo, and so that I think that has been the main kind of platform that is that people have kind of latched onto. One of the things that doesn't bode very well is that one of the first announcements that he did make was that that the Philippine government or the Philippine Army he plans to upgrade and provide more money to the Philippine Army to end the insurgencies that have been taking place in the Philippines, and so that I think is definitely the wrong direction, and it's perhaps not a very good sign that more money is going towards the armies instead of towards the health system and the education system and towards poor people.
So how can people here in Canada support the campaign to free the Morong 43?
One of the ways is through the internet, actually. There's a blog called freethehealthworkers.blogspot.com, and it has on there a very clear description of the health workers and what happened, as well as a number of letters that have been written internationally. And so they have been welcoming letters from international organizations or from individuals. Especially now, I think it's a very opportune time to do that, while Noinoi Aquino is still in the first kind of days of his presidency. And also you can get a little bit more information on our website, which is APHVAN, as in Vancouver. So it's aphvan.wordpress.com.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, David, and all the best in the campaign.
Okay, thank you, Peter.
I have been speaking with David Hendry. He's an organizer with the Alliance for People's Health. If you'd like more information on the campaign to free the Morong 3, you can visit www.freethehealthworkers.blogspot.com. Or if you'd like more information on the Alliance for People's Health, David's organization, you can see their website at www.aphvan.wordpress.com.
John and Roy with High on a Hill. There are thousands of immigrant workers working agriculture in BC. Many of them come under the federal seasonal agricultural workers program, which many argue is exploitative and unjust. Justicia for Immigrant Workers is a volunteer-driven collective committed to organizing with and for immigrant farm workers and their families. Erica Carmen Del Fuchs is an organizer with the Justicia in BC. Maria recently had the opportunity to talk to Erica about the situation of immigrant farm workers in BC. Here's a recording of that interview.
Who are the migrant workers in BC?
In BC, there are tens of thousands. I don't remember the last numbers of different kinds of migrant workers. So migrant workers can be temporary farm workers. That's workers that are here with a work permit for a defined period of time, or open or closed work permit, or undocumented workers. So both are migrant workers. So we have workers working, for example, in farm workers that are in the valley, primarily in Fraser Valley or the Okanagan or different parts of the province, and they're here through usually the seasonal agriculture workers program, which we call the SAP, and they're usually here from Mexico. There's, I think, a few from the Caribbean as well, and also with an agreement with the International Organization of Migration. They're coming from Guatemala, and most recently there are some workers here from Kenya as well, through the low-skilled temporary farm worker program. And then we have many workers that come in into other sectors, such as construction, hospitality, and, of course, the living caregivers, which we have thousands of in BC and throughout the country. Primarily, over 95% are from the Philippines. So we have migrant workers in all different sectors. And like I said, the key thing to highlight is there are both temporary farm workers, which is the term the government assigns to documented migrant workers, and then there are undocumented migrant workers, which means that they don't actually have work permits.
Okay, so you mentioned the Federal Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yes. So this is a program that is it's negotiated between federal governments. So it actually initiated in 1966 out east between the Caribbean, certain Caribbean countries, and the federal Canadian government. And then it was expanded in 1974 to include Mexico. And in BC, we saw it first start in 2004 with about 45 workers. Most of them were in Victoria and then came over to the Valley and did a bit of berry picking. But then we see in progressive years, the number increased till I think last year's over 3,000 migrant farm workers, primarily from Mexico, but also from Guatemala. The ones from Guatemala, I think there's a higher percentage of women that are coming in. And from Mexico, it's mostly men, or in the past there's been single mothers. And they come in, I mean, I could go on and on. They come in pretty precarious situation. They come from periods of about, I think it's 6 weeks to a maximum of 8 months per year. And some of them are coming, like, to Canada for 15, 20 years, yet always remain with a temporary status. And when you have a temporary status, it's sort of like you have temporary rights. You know, you're, it doesn't, without the permanent status or without that, be able to apply for permanent status immediately, it really leaves these workers vulnerable to exploitation, and not just vulnerable, but they are exploited. And they are deported by their employers without the, for speaking out, for getting sick, for having an accident, without the Canadian government doing anything, in fact, enabling these deportations, which workers shouldn't be deported. Right? And just the conditions are, I mean, I could go on, housing and working conditions alike or leave a lot to be desired because of the general context of farm workers in BC, not just migrant farm workers, but the whole history of exploitation of farm workers, primarily Punjabi farm workers in the Fraser Valley, but also in the Okanagan.
So can you describe the situation of these workers in terms of both work conditions and housing conditions?
Sure. So the workers that come from Mexico and from Guatemala, especially the ones from Mexico, they come in with a contract, right, and negotiate between federal governments. They have, the workers have no say in the contract. It's never, it's usually contracts that are negotiated between employee and employer. This is not the case. There's no worker input. And so that's a good starting point to kind of explain everything else that happens. The workers are tied to one employer. That means they have a closed work permit. They cannot change employers at will. If they have any problems with their current employer, that employer must give them permission to transfer. So it's not like any other worker who has what we call labor mobility or labor like that freedom to go from job to job if we have a problem, or, you know, to, they don't have that. So it really, that's another major issue. So it, these are all factors and structural issues in the program, the Seasonal Agriculture Workers Program, that really lead to greater vulnerability and greater exploitation of workers. So we see conditions, for example, farm workers in general are excluded also from employment certain employment standards legislation that has to do with overtime pay and statutory holiday pay. So workers can work, I mean, technically they can work 24 hours a day. As long as they say yes, that's okay. They can be worked, you know, as much as the employer wants them to. So in high season, they're sometimes working double shifts and sometimes working 6-7 days a week.
So what does that mean? Does that mean working 18 hours a day, or what does that look like?
It looks like anywhere from, like, I guess in the high periods from 12 to any and above hours, right? And that means no overtime pay, and also for the Mexican farm workers, the employer is supposed to give them housing, but the housing sometimes is less than adequate conditions. Sometimes there's quite a few workers jammed into one room. Sometimes they have just one stove. Sometimes the elements aren't working, and there's like 10 or 12 in the house, and they all have to share one stove, right, with limited time. They have one fridge. Sometimes that fridge isn't working. They have to put all their grocery in there. Sometimes they don't have transportation to buy their groceries, you know. And this is workers who get one day off a week, if that. Sometimes they don't even have a phone. They can't call anybody. They can't call their family, which is the reason they're even in Canada in the first place. Or they can't call to, you know, if they've made friends in Canada, or if they want to know, you know, if they have a problem and they need to call, you know, who's DC or, you know, someone mm-hmm. to help them out. So we see all those kind of conditions. And then on the actual work, there's a lot of issues around pesticides. Canada generally doesn't have very good pesticide laws, but for migrant workers, or both Mexican and also immigrant farm workers, the Punjabi population primarily, since Punjabi and Spanish are the dominant languages in the farm agriculture work sector, apart from English, probably more than English, they don't usually get trained in their own language. There isn't signage in their own language that often, and sometimes they don't have the necessary applicator licenses. If you can apply pesticides in BC, you're supposed to have an applicator license. They're not trained. They don't have that license. They're applying pesticides, or they're in the field and the pesticide's being applied with them without them being told what pesticide it is, how long they're supposed to stay out of the field for. Because there's, depending on the level of toxicity of a pesticide, you're supposed to stay away from the field that's been sprayed for something, I think, 24 to 48 hours. I'm not sure on the exact terms. So all those things don't get respected, and we know that the effects of being exposed to pesticides can include deformations in children that are born to mothers who were in the fields, but also when the worker goes back home and doesn't wash their clothes or doesn't wash them properly, the children or other people in that home can be exposed to the pesticides and also get sick through that, and there are a lot of studies around that. So imagine these workers who are all crammed in a house, you know, and don't have a chance to sometimes even cook. They don't have enough time to cook or to don't have space to store their food and maybe have one washing machine, even that, right? And sometimes fire for all these, usually men that are in one house. It just creates a really dangerous situation, right? And these are not uncommon situations, right? There are worst-case scenarios. There's case scenarios where we know where workers have been in warehouses as housing, sleeping beside the pesticides.
Really? Oh, that's really upsetting to hear about.
We're having to cook in the open air in gas stoves in the open air while it's raining, to living in trailers and with no heating. And, you know, even in the summer right now, it's cold, right? But they're here. Some of these workers come from as early as January till they're here usually till about December, I think, 10th or 15th is the last day they're allowed to be here. Mm-hmm. So those are just some of the things that, and not to mention the employers that often can be very abusive. With a case just recently of some workers in Chilliwack that the employer called them Mexican garbage, and there was other abuse inflicted on them.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you that. What do you see generally is the role of the farmers who are employing these people? What are their responsibilities, and how are they owing up to those responsibilities at this point?
Well, we like to say, as at least as exclusive farmland workers, we don't. Some people say they're good farmers or bad farmers. We don't even like to classify it in that way, because we believe that there are structural problems with the program that really allows for the exploitation of workers, right? So of course there are some farmers that are better than others, but that's not the analysis we make. We think that it really the program is just leaves it really too open for farmers or agribusiness or whatever. I wouldn't even call all of, you know, everyone farmers. I would say agribusiness in some senses, right? To exploit these workers. So we see a whole gamut of different situations, you know, where there are larger operations and and I guess in most situations, the business, right? So productivity is like the top of everyone's mind, right? So workers are really kept on them to make sure that they're producing, you know, quick. And sometimes we've seen, certainly in some of the greenhouses, that some of the safety precautions are not quite there. There'll be like broken rails. There's little carts you move around in the greenhouses, at least in the tomato greenhouses. And those carts can be really dangerous. If you go too fast, you can fall and hurt yourself, and many workers have. So just that pressure that a supervisor and employer can exert on workers, mm-hmm. it creates this, let's call it an environment that's not conducive to proper occupational health and safety.
Right, and especially if they, you know, don't have the option of quitting their job or seeking out other employment.
Definitely, and if they get hurt or are sick and want to go to the doctor, there's a few things that happen. Sometimes employers will take them to doctors that are friendly to them. And you know, when you have a work-related accident or illness, you're supposed to say it's work-related when you go to the doctors, so that the doctor is then obligated to fill out the workers' compensation board form, mm-hmm. safe BC form. But because sometimes the farmers or the employers know the doctors, that doesn't happen, and the worker cannot speak for themselves because they don't often speak English. And so we've seen many cases where an employee, a worker, a farm worker, a migrant farm worker's rights and illness and accident are not taken seriously and can result in something more serious, whether it be from like what might seem like pesticide exposure and having a runny nose to, you know, runny eyes, which then cause other problems, to a situation of a worker. This is a few years ago. He didn't want to complain. They finally took him to walk-in clinic. The walk-in clinic said they couldn't really do anything because he didn't have the proper medical coverage, and he ended up having two full strokes, and I think we believe also another partial one, and I was actually there for one of the strokes because he had it in the hospital. And I'm not a doctor, but it seems like if they had possibly done a CT scan, I think it was, after the first stroke, they might have been able to prevent the future ones, right? And he's now disabled for life.
Oh my God.
And luckily we were there, so he was able to do some therapy in Canada before he went back to Mexico. But other workers have died. And I've met widows in Mexico, right?
Mm-hmm.
A widow of a worker who had chemicals, I think pesticides, spill on him in a greenhouse in Ontario, and the employer wouldn't let him go shower and wash it off. And it got worse and worse, and he died, actually.
That's just absolutely heartbreaking to hear about. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned criminalization of these workers. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, I think the criminalization is really in the context of criminalizing migrant workers in general, and certainly anyone who speaks out, and certainly right now in Canada, I think this is a big, it's always been a big issue, but it's a sort of a historic thing. Like, there's always been a criminalization, especially of migrant workers of color. You know, we don't have the same criminalization when these migrant workers are white, right, or European. Like, and we see this case with a historic case that just happened recently, the cattle line case. There was Latin American workers that worked on the cattle line for the Olympics, and there were European workers, and the Latin American workers got paid less than the European migrant workers. And of course they got paid less than the Canadian workers, right? So we're really talking about racism, formalization, or no, in this case it was a wage distinction, but that the racism that exists through wages exists in other levels. Employers will often use very racialized terms to talk about migrant farm workers.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, we see this here in BC too, but in Ontario, because there's so many migrant workers from both Mexico and Caribbean nations, and the workers from the Caribbean nations are by far mostly black, right? You will hear a lot of racialized terms used to describe the, you know, differences between Mexican workers and Caribbean workers, and yeah, I don't even want to. I mean, not beyond not acceptable. I mean, racist.
Right.
And I was going to say owners, employers, and if you see the documentary about migrant farm workers in Ontario, the documentary El Contrato, one of the employers, an Italian greenhouse owner, well, she's Canadian, Italian-Canadian greenhouse owner, actually refers to the workers as, you know, sort of like, as though she was the owner in terms that, like, kind of like a slave-owner relationship. They really see them as just theirs, right? Our guys. And just the way they talk about a lot of employers, some employers talk about them, is just very in that terms, like they're the owners and the workers at their beck and call are very controlled by them, and so much so that employers tell workers not to talk to anybody else, and they really create this climate of fear and for the workers, and have them really isolated so that they can't speak out, so they really are productive for the employers and not really here as human beings. They actually have the right to not just work, but to have a life, because they are spending a large part of their lives in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, that term temporary is actually quite in a name for many workers, at least in the migrant farm worker area. It's a misleading term. It's an incorrect term, because they're actually quite, they're here for a large part of their lives, and yet cannot apply for permanent residence status ever.
Right. So, given all of that, what is, do you see as the most important struggle for migrant workers in BC right now? What are you at the CCF for migrant workers focusing on at this moment?
Well, some of the key things we've historically asked for that we still haven't gotten were basic things like medical coverage, like the MSP coverage for workers immediately upon arrival, permanent resident status, the ability to apply for permanent resident status immediately. But right now we're also seeing very basic things like the need for basically breaking that fear and isolation that's really around migrant farm workers, and especially with the attempts of some workers to unionize. There's many other forms to organize besides unionization, but the ones who were unionizing, they faced quite a lot of backlash as well. And
from the labor movement, or from where? Tell me more about that.
Yes. So some workers that we knew, some different farms, had organized into a union. Many, like I said, there had been wildcat strikes and work stoppages prior to that. So already organization, but some of them organized into a union. And this, there was strong backlash from the employer groups, mostly the BC Ag Council, the BC Agricultural Council, which groups quite a few employers, and also WALI, Western Agricultural Labor Initiative. So they took a challenge to the workers. They challenged the workers' right to unionize. Just like in other provinces, I think not all migrants, actually, not all farm workers had the right to organize. I think in Ontario they recently got it. So basically, it's an attack on a person's, forget migrant worker, but on a farm worker's, a worker's, and especially a migrant farm worker's right to speak out, that employer groups would challenge their right to organize themselves and for better conditions, right? Whether that be in a union or any other way. And employers are often very abusive to both the workers and to anyone who tries to talk to them, to support them, to befriend them even,
mm-hmm.
Or support them with rights issues. So really, I think we need to break that through that climate of fear and isolation that employers try to create. And I think when we were talking a bit earlier about the food movement, I think that this is a key, something that's really missing. In BC, there's a lot of talk about local and organic food and this foodie movement, like it's something really progressive. But when people talk about food, they talk about and are very concerned about the farmers. But I think people never mention the farm workers, you know, and farm workers are on, you know, I don't know what the statistics are. I don't know if they're on all farms in BC, but they're in many farms. If it only be one or two or a few hundred in a greenhouse operation, you know. And it's really missing from the discussion is the issue of, like, food justice.
Right. And what do you think that is?
I think that it's kind of like a little bit like maybe the environmental movement in BC and the food movement is really dominated by, I think, it's still very white and it's still very middle class. So it doesn't include or definitely doesn't have at the forefront the people who are most affected by unjust social or economic policies, right? Which are racialized communities, which are communities of color, whether they be resident citizens, documented or undocumented migrant workers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Aren't really included in that movement, and they're certainly not at the forefront, which is where I think many of our grassroots organizers believe that those who should be at the front of this of a movement, a real movement for change, social and economic change, should be those who are most affected by the system. And that means racialized communities of color, specifically women, children, elders, you know. And we don't, I think we can see that there's an absence of the people who are most affected.
Mm-hmm.
Most, in many parts of the movement, like, certainly in the food movement, right, which is really framed around local food or sometimes food security, but it really is about food justice, food sovereignty. And I think in the Indigenous community, the First Nations community, there is a lot more there's a lot of work being done around food sovereignty.
Can you just explain that term? Like, why are you using the term food sovereignty over, let's say, food security?
Well, I use the word food justice a bit more, actually. Food sovereignty is like having sort of like control over the means of food production, over the land, everything, right? So I think the people in BC, I think the people who are most entitled to talk about food sovereignty, because it's about land sovereignty and, you know, autonomous government and all that, are First Nations of, you know, BC, because this is unceded territory, right? So I think the word sovereignty is best applied to the First Nations people here in BC. But certainly the term food justice would be an appropriate one, because it would include the treatment of farm workers and farmers, too, because not all farmers are big-time farmers and not all of them are abusive, right? And there definitely is issues facing farmers. But and also, if we include the term food justice or the idea of local, organic, and just food or fair food, just is a better, stronger term, it would also include the whole concept of ensuring there is, like we talk about accessible and healthy and all this food for people, it would break through the concept of charity that really also prevails in some of the food discourses, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
that poor people don't really have a right to dignified food. They need to line up in food banks to get food that isn't really food. It's, you know, like a fellow food activist, food justice activist says, you know, it's kind of like, that's not real food. So food justice incorporates not just treatment of farm workers, it also incorporates the people receiving the food. So it really looks at the whole food system and whether is it just? Is it just for the people who produce it? Is it just for the people who receive it? And, of course, you can also incorporate a key part of all that, which is the environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Food's people. It's not an environment just about the trees and, you know, the air and the water and all that, but the people who depend on it, all of us. And it ties back to a lot of, I never even brought this up, but the migrant farm workers coming from here are farmers, are campesinos back home, or were. But because of capitalism and imperialist practice, we've seen, and particularly with Mexico, NAFTA, we've seen a push, you know, away from their farmlands towards the north or towards the cities, right? So food justice, food sovereignty addresses those issues. It looks at the root causes. Food sovereignty is a term actually that was developed by one of the largest campesino peasant movements in the world called Via Campesina, and it incorporates a struggle for land. It's a political term. It means more than just access to food. It means access to land, the means of production, putting the control in people's hands again, not in the hands of corporations.
That was Erica Carmen Del Fuchs in an organizer with the Justiça for Migrant Workers BC. Roger Farr is the author of a book of poetry called Surplus and the editor of the magazine called Parser, New Poetry and Poetics. He is part of the Black Ink Writers Group, and he teaches in the Creative Writing and Culture and Technology program at Capilano University in Vancouver, BC. The poem you're about to hear is recorded at a recent event at Spartacus Books in the downtown East Side.
It is what the people want in a very literal sense. What the people want is a more thorough conversation on reproductive health issues. The people want a worthy successor, because it is what the people want. What the people want is a united front of all progressive forces. The people want an application equivalent to shop savvy. Biased news is not what the people want. The people want another invasion. Clean diesel is what the people want. What the people want is a way of keeping in touch with what matters to people today. Contrary to what you may believe, this is not what the people want. Communism is not what the people want. Credit card processing is what the people want. The people want unpredictable biological children. What the people want is bacon. The people want chicken. What the people want is candor. The people want application software. Every poll shows this is not what the people want. Free higher education is what the people want. Growth is not what the people want. The people want cold beer and hot showers. The people want usable devices. What the people want is chicken. He does so because it is what the people want. The people want for their team to reach the finals. He is not what the people want. The people want for their team to reach the finals. What the people want is a door. I can say and know this is not what the people want. The people want for us to stop having these rhetorical wars and start solving the problem. I sincerely believe that lasting peace is what the people want. I think this is what the people want. If well-designed and quirky sportswear is what the people want, then let's give it to them. The people want invariably the same as what the person using the phrase wants. What the people want is for our laws against gambling to be uniformly enforced. The people want very simple things. What the people want is for you to try. It gives them greater confidence to just continue lying that this is what the people want. It is not what the people want. The people want the protest to end. What the people want is forever secondary to what the movers and shakers want. The people want to look at stuff. The people want more effective selling time with better leads that have high odds of converting into pipeline opportunities. It may be a little too risky to place our faith in some dialectical claim that this is not what the people want. Legislation is not what the people want. Of course, it is dangerous to propitiate violence, but armed conflict is what the people want. Peace of mind is what the people want. People never get the government they deserve because government is not what the people want. What the people want is health services that are accessible. What the people want is irrelevant, and I'm not sure if it's salvageable. The people want not often what we give in our information and services. The people want to reduce the malicious abuse at all levels. The people want what our forebears wanted. The people want widescreen DVDs. Right now is not what the people want. This is not what the people want. The left always thinks they know what's best for the country while refusing to accept that what they want is not what the people want. The people want a revolution. The people want peace. What the people want is not difficult. The people want a government that obeys the law. Perhaps the current system of self-serving professional politicians and ambitious lawyers really is what the people want. The people want a real debate. The PNG Community Coalition Against Corruption says this is what the people want. The spending in this bill is not what the people want. The health reform bill is not what the people want. What the people want is not taken into consideration. This is not what the people want. This is what the people want. The people want similar unanimity for the solution of their problems. This is what the people want, a jingle, if you will. This kind of sudden change in Iran is not what the people want. The people want simply what is reasonable. What the people want is simple. This landscape is what the people want. To me, that's not true. That is not what the people want. The people want to see a mask over her face. Too much reality is not what the people want. The people want some deal stitched behind closed doors without the consent of the British. What the people want is a single-payer Medicare for all coverage. We have to limit the power of trade unions because that is what the people want. What is popular is what the people want. The people want someone to listen. The people want someone who will be there for them no matter what. What is important is what the people want. What Team Obama is doing is not what the people want. The people want the key to having a good business. Despite over 90% public disapproval, it goes without saying that this is not what the people want. After all, this is what the people want.
And so that last poem was by Roger Farr. He's a Vancouver poet, and that was at a anarchist writer circle at Spartacus Books in the downtown east side. That's it, the end for today's show. You're listening to Worm's Eye View, news from the grassroots. Worm's Eye View is a volunteer, open volunteer show. We're always looking for more folks to get involved. It's open, low commitment, and people can submit what they want. You can reach us for more information about this at wormseyeradio@gmail.com. And we are joined today by Maria Pashtotter and Jessica Deacon, all researching, writing, and producing. I'm Peter Driftmeyer.